Welcome everybody to my second podcast. Today I'm going to talk about our upcoming Nordic program with three awesome Nordic composers. Now, before I'm getting into that, I personally got fascinated by the Nordic countries quite a while ago during my time as assistant and associate conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. At that time, my boss, the music director, was Esa-Pekka Salonen, a Finnish gentleman who's very calm, quiet, let's say deep, intense demeanor was very fascinating. And his interpretations of Sibelius, actually of all repertoire, but specifically of Sibelius, were mind-opening, mind-boggling and opening my mind. And I will never forget those. Now, if you think of, let's say, Finland, what comes to mind? Lakes. There are 180,000 lakes in Finland. Of course, saunas. Some of you have heard of the Kalevala, the Finnish national epic about the creation of the earth, something that was put into music several times. And of course, ice hockey. I lived in Canada the last 12 years, as you probably know, and in 2016 was the epic finals between Canada and Finland. And guess who won? Well, the Canadians won. When you think of Iceland, what comes to mind? Gosh, fire and ice, of course, volcanoes, and maybe that beautiful, what's it called, the Blue Lagoon. So a country also that people nowadays might know from the Game of Thrones or from other movies that try to film in exotic locations. I was lucky to visit Reykjavik 10 years ago with a good friend of mine, Matthew Patton. We went up there to talk with artists and to create connections between actually Reykjavik and at that time Winnipeg. A couple of things stood out. One was a fun coffee with Kjartan Sveinsson, the pianist of Sigur Rós. Then we visited several performances at the new concert hall. If you have not seen it, take a look online. It's absolutely stunning. It's called Harpa and is right at the water. Right at the water and is reflecting the sky and the blues of the water. And the third thing that stood out was a volcanic eruption that happened on my last day in Reykjavik. I was supposed to go to the airport, but a volcano erupted and I had to go back to the hotel. And from my window, I could see slowly the cloud of ash drifting in, and nobody knew how long it would take. Fortunately, it was only like a 24-hour thing. And the next day I could leave. Let's start with Inuani Rautavaara's Cantus Arcticus. Rautavaara was born in Helsinki in 1928. He studied actually in Tanglewood, at the home for the Boston Symphony with Aaron Copland. And he studied at the Juilliard School. And his two fellow students were Philip Glass and Steve Reich, the godfathers of minimalism. Rautavaara composed 9 operas, 1 ballet, 8 symphonies, and 12 concerti, and he taught at the Sibelius Academy for many years. He became famous, at least for me, of depictions of music of celestial beings, as he wrote that when he was younger, when he was a kid, he had visions of angels. There's a beautiful quote of his that I want to read to you. Quote, "It is my belief that music is great if at some point, the listener catches a glimpse of eternity through the window of time. This, to my mind, is the only true justification for all art. Everything else is of secondary importance." That was a quote by Rautavaara. There are several works by composers in the past that actually used birds or the idea of animals in music. What comes to mind is, of course, Vivaldi's Four Seasons. You have the dog barking and you have birds in the background imitated through music. You have, of course, Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, the 6th symphony, specifically the 2nd movement with the cuckoo at the end. You have the famous French composer Olivier Messiaen, who wrote many works based on bird song. One is Le Mer Noir for flute and piano based on songs of blackbirds. And another one is Epode from Chronochromie, which was actually written for 18 violins, where every violin player is playing a different bird song. Another composer that comes to mind is John Sibelius himself. Sibelius was inspired by swans flying over his head while he was composing the Fifth Symphony, which gave him the inspiration for the theme of the last movement. I would like to play you a little interview between the famous conductor pianist Vladimir Ashkenazy and Roger Vara. Vladimir Ashkenazy is talking about the first piano concerto that was written for him and is talking about the inner music and the form, the arch. And then you hear Roger Vara's voice expanding on that thought and delving deeper into his way of composing.
But I must say that I enjoyed playing this piece very much. You know what I especially enjoyed, I think? The arch in each of the movements. In each three movements, there was a total coherence of material that you sort of felt that from the very beginning of the piece, you could see the end of it. And when you finished each movement, you thought of the beginning of it, which for me has a great value. It means that there is an inner logic in the piece. And I felt that in all the three movements, a little bit nostalgic somewhere, very atmospheric, and very, like in German say, innig, very much introvert rather than extrovert. Of course, there are some places in the piece that are extrovert, only to underline the inner world of the piece.
That's very good. I'm very happy to hear that. And when I still was teaching at the Sibelius Academy, teaching composition 10 years ago, I still was there. Then I used often to say to my students, please don't force your music. Try to listen to it and to find out what it wants. Because a work of art has its own will. That's not only me who says that, but for instance, Thomas Mann has said exactly the same thing. A work of art has an own will. It wants to become. And it uses its creator as a tool and instrument, says Thomas Mann. So consequently, composing ought to be an organic process where the music sort of grows by itself, grows according to its own laws.
If I were a composer or a writer or a poet, I would adopt the same attitude. I would listen to my inner world and see that the work of art has to emerge somehow. And not, I couldn't compose it. It has to be composed. Yeah. I couldn't compose it, which is quite a difference.
Quite a difference. In the very beginning, with my very first pieces, I always, when it was completed, and I thought this maybe a little piece for piano or song or something, I thought this is quite good. It's complete. It's exactly as it ought to be. Mm. Nothing to take away, nothing to add. Then I had the notion that I am not able to make anything like that. It must have been somewhere always. I've always been an instrument to take it down from somewhere, maybe a platonic world of ideas or something like that. It must have been somewhere. And I've not invented it, but found it. Wasn't it Picasso who said once, an admirer in his atelier said, Master, how is it possible that you invent all those things? And Picasso said, je n'invente pas, je trouve. I find, I find.
The Concerto for Birds is written in three movements. First one is called The Bog. Second, Melancholy, and the third movement is called Swans Migrating. Well, as a general feel, you will have a beautiful orchestra structure and then a soundtrack that Mr. Rautavaara recorded above the Arctic Circle, different kinds of birds that he now then tries to put into the orchestra fabric. In Finnish, Finland is pronounced Suomi, which means the land of bogs or swamps. Now, the orchestra, as I mentioned, is in the foreground in this work, and the birds in the background, and then it goes back and forth, where sometimes you have the birds come out of the woodwinds, for example, and then go back into the background again. The first movement, The Bog, starts with two flutes going back and forth as if they would talk with each other. You have at some point a beautiful string melody come in and the trombone, the brass. Over the stretch, you will have the bird sounds go in and out, as I mentioned earlier, and creating this beautiful tapestry. The second movement, Melancholy, is a slowed down recording of two shore larks calling back and forth to one another. And you have again the birds as a soloist communicating with the orchestra underneath in the background. The third movement, Swans Migrating. Here you have four orchestral groups slowly coming together in one very long crescendo and then back again a decrescendo. And Rautavaara was writing, "I imagined the swans fly straight to the burning sun." Here the beginning of the first movement of Rautavaara's Concerto for Birds, and just see how beautiful and simple the two flutes go back and forth communicating, and then out of that sound how the actual bird recordings just slowly come out of. Second example I want to play for you is also the first movement, and here a little further in you suddenly will hear the strings play this grandiose chorale, very romantic, with major harmonies, and again the birds go in and out of that, fly around it, around that melody in a very enlivening manner. Our next piece on the program is by the Icelandic composer Johan Johansson, and it's called Fordlandia. Before I'm going to talk more about it, just on a side note, you might remember that in the last 2 years I often on-programmed music that was a little bit more crossover. You might remember The Life of Pi, the music, the film music to The Life of Pi. Then we had programmed the film music to the movie There Will Be Blood by Johnny Greenwood from the band Radiohead. And in that same spirit, I picked this particular work now in our Nordic program. Johan Johansson grew up in Reykjavik. He lived from 1969 to 2018, and he became quite famous, particularly in the last 8 years. He worked together with the director Denis Villeneuve on several films. Names that come to mind are Prisoners, Sicario, the famous movie Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, and then The Theory of Everything, where he received the Golden Globe for in 2015. Here, a short interview of Johan Johansson, where he's talking a little bit about the process of composition.
Oh, I'm speaking with composer Johan Johansson, whose fantastic score to the film Prisoners made every ear in the industry perk up and listen. This year, he is behind the score to the critically acclaimed The Theory of Everything, which is based on Jane Hawking's book about her life with her husband, Stephen Hawking. Johan, thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, we've never spoken before, so I'd love to know how you got started in music and what made you kind of go to the path of film composing.
Well, I've been you know, playing music, you know, since I was a kid, and you know, playing. My first instrument was trombone. Actually, I played trombone and in brass bands and things like that, wind bands and. And then I moved to piano and studied piano, sort of, which became my main instrument, really. And I guess I started, you know, writing, you know, as a composer. I started out writing for theater and music for theater, and you know, spent many years in Iceland writing theater music, where I kind of, you know, developed my style, really. Got the opportunity to write for you know, ensembles, you know, smaller ensembles, you know, string quartets and chamber ensembles, and then you know, sort of my first albums as a solo artist were based on music that I was writing for the theater. So like the my first solo album, Englebjørn, was a kind of suite that I created out of music that I wrote for a play of the same name. And I think I wrote for the theater in a very cinematic way, you know, and my music has always been very cinematic and very visual. I've always sort of, you know, written music in a very visual way, and then kind of, you know, having images in my head when I'm writing, and you know, the music kind of tends to start with an image, and so it's very natural for me to write, you know, to picture, and then you know, people started, once my records got out there, and you know, they started to get licensed for films and things like that, and then filmmakers started to approach me to write for films and to write film scores. And so it was just sort of a slow process, you know, kind of a very, very kind of organic process in a way.
That's awesome. That's really cool how your music spoke to filmmakers.
Fordlandia is Johan Johansson's sixth full-length studio album from 2008, and it is about the failure of Henry Ford's Brazilian rubber plant. Yes, you heard it correctly, Henry Ford. Now, as you might know the story, in 1928, Henry Ford built a rubber plant in the Amazon rainforest in order to elude the British monopoly over the supply of rubber. At that time, there was no road access to that particular location, so all the building materials had to be brought by boat. It was a planned community. Everything had to be built from scratch, from roads to actual buildings. And buildings included a hospital, a school, a library, hotel, swimming pool, playground, and a golf course. Well, that particular project only lasted for 6 years. In 1934, the city was already abandoned. And you can imagine, there were so many problems with it. Malaria, it was very dangerous to live there. Then actually, the rubber itself. They were amazed to create synthetic rubber. So it was the demand actually dried off. But the remains are still to be seen. If you go on YouTube, you can see several documentaries about that particular project and about the buildings. And this is exactly what fascinated Johan Johansson to write that particular work. Now, it is about 10 minutes long and is very emotional and is grandiose. It starts soft and then builds and builds and builds, as if you feel and you see that building, the building of that monstrosity of a factory, of a city in the rainforest. And then what he does is this: the music slowly starts to slow down. It gets slower and slower and slower, as if that colossus of that engine of the factory is actually slowing down to the point of complete still stand. Here's a short excerpt. As I mentioned, it is building and building, and in our version you have the full orchestra imitating not only the strings but also the guitars and the computer sounds. And here now a short excerpt of the end, when the whole thing starts to slow down and to grind to a halt. The third piece on the program is by Sibelius, Jean Sibelius' Symphony No. 7. I'm not sure how you feel about Nordic music so far. I really enjoy it a lot. There, one big difference for me is that composers from Finland, or Iceland in this case, have almost like impressionist feels to them. Yes, there is a Germanic way of composing with a first theme, a second theme, in a very logical fashion, but then there is a whole different dimension where it is about the emotional background, or the feel of the scenery, of the climate, of the light. And that is something that those Nordic composers feel are creating in a very beautiful way. Sibelius was born in 1865 and lived quite a long life. He was 91 years old when he passed on in 1957. Well, most of you might know two works, Finlandia, which became a little bit the unofficial Finnish anthem, and then the other pieces, The Swan of Tuonela, two very romantic works. Sibelius grew up in the countryside. He had a very strong interest in and love for nature. His family had moved to the southern coast of Finland, to a place called Loviisa, He learned to play the piano and the violin, and it was actually very, very advanced on the violin, and had hoped to become a violin soloist. But fate went into a different direction, and through an accident, he was not able to continue with the violin, but started to really to dig into composition. He studied in Helsinki with Martin Vergelius and with Ferruccio Busoni, the Italian composer who for a very short time taught in Helsinki. In 1889, he actually moved to Berlin for a year to study in Berlin with Albert Becker. And then he went to Vienna from 1990 to 91 and studied with a very, very famous composition teacher, Robert Fuchs. Robert Fuchs. And Mr. Fuchs had actually many famous students. Amongst them was Gustav Mahler, Korngold, Zemlinsky, and Hugo Wolf. In this case, Sibelius really learned the craft of composition from German masters and then put this into use with his Nordic mindset. Jean Sibelius wrote several tone poems and he wrote seven symphonies. The first one was in 1899, his first symphony. The second symphony, which we performed with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic 2 years ago, became his biggest success, a huge success. And then in 1924, several years after the First World War, he wrote his seventh symphony, which was to become his last symphony. Now, the interesting thing is that he only wrote two more works after that seventh symphony. Actually, he also wrote an eighth symphony that he destroyed in a fire. But then the last 20-something years in his life, he was silent. He did not compose anymore, taught a little bit, but left it at this with his oeuvre. Again, I have a very short interview with Jean Sibelius, where his grandson is asking him how long he has been living in his country estate. And then Jean Sibelius answers, 43 years. Actually, I'm mentioning it because the whole interview is in Finnish.
Saanko aluksi tiedustella teiltä, professori Sibelius, kuinka kauan olette asunut Ainolassa?
Se on kai 43 vuotta.
Pitkä aika sitten. Käykö täällä Ainolassa paljon vieraita?
Käypi. Etenkin ulkomaalaisia.
Sibelius wrote extensively a diary and then gave many other interviews. And I want to read you a couple of diary quotes that give a feel how he perceived the world and how he perceived nature. He's writing in his diary in October 1914. The autumn sun is shining, nature in its farewell colors. My heart is singing sadly, the shadows grow longer. The adagio of my fifth symphony, that I, poor fellow, that I am, can have moments of such richness. And in 1923, he's writing into his diary, my life definitely is finished. If just once I'm in a merry mood and take a glass, I have to suffer for it for a long time afterwards. This terrible depression, which I know cannot understand and which I have inherited from my ancestors. Because I'm so thin-skinned or lacking in confidence, I know and the children will never receive proper support in life. End of quote. And I know is actually his wife. His symphony number 7 is unusual in the sense that it is actually one movement alone. He has several different parts in it, different themes, but the piece is about 20 minutes long and is written in one movement. The first excerpt I'm going to play is actually the beginning of the work, and it's an iconic beginning. It starts with a little timpani point, and then a scale that starts in the celli, goes through the all the string instruments up two bars, and ends with a minor chord in the woodwinds. And it is as if from Mother Earth, from deep down, the curtain opens and starts a journey that is at the end very organical and is growing like a plant where one after the other is unfolding, one theme after the other is unfolding and coming from the previous music. Here's the beginning.
Thank you.
Now we have the second theme. The second theme is with full orchestra forces. You have everybody playing, but one instrument is shining, and that's the trombone. So you have in full C major, in that very brilliant, positive, joyful key, a melody performed that is then going back and forth, starting in trombone and going back and forth between woodwinds, horn, trumpet, a chorale, a very powerful chorale this time. And he personally said, "This is, I know, this is my wife." Now here's the fourth example I would like to play for you. It's his fourth theme. And well, if you think of pastoral symphonies, pastoral pieces, what comes to mind? Beethoven's Sixth Symphony again. And what it is, it's an organic growing, a very gentle way of composition, especially the first movement of his Sixth Symphony, of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony. Now here in Sibelius's fourth theme, you have the woodwinds starting, then the horns take over, and the strings finish that little arc. Let's listen to it. As I mentioned, the Seventh Symphony was the last symphony he finished, and he was not at the end of his life, but the end of his artistic life. As a conductor, one thing that is very obvious is that at that point in his development, he was almost devoid of ego. He had music pouring out of him in a very organic way. I would like to read you a quote by Osmo Venske, the Finnish conductor, who's the music director of the Minneapolis Symphony, who wrote this about Sibelius. "The Seventh Symphony forms a pair with the Sixth, but it is not autographical. The ego is left behind, and things are seen from the point of view of humanity. The composer turns his eye away from himself towards higher powers. Number 7 is sacred music, This piece, too, is very difficult to play. That's a quote by Osmo Wenske. And from my perspective, that's very true. As I mentioned, there is what is missing is a urge, a drive that comes from the passionate view of the individual composer. It is as if he was taking himself out, and again, like a plant, it is organically growing in it, all its beauty and variety, and shifting from that beginning, from that scale that is coming out of the ground, the very first bar, to a very glorious chorale at the end, the finale, in a beautiful C major chord.